For the week of March 29th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 275, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in the township of Soweto in South Africa, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, I have no idea what you're doing in South Africa.
I'm trying to boost my career.
Okay, I'm going to go with no idea which... Wait a second. This doesn't have anything to do with that whole Daily Show mess, does it?
It certainly does. It's not a mess. It's an announcement. It's news, and we'll get to it later on. But first, don't we have some thanks to give?
Yes, we do, because last week I was so good at posting the show that I posted the week prior. I basically posted episode 273, where episode 274 should go. So there were two episode 273s.
So good you wanted to hear it twice.
That's right, yes. And, you know, we had a couple of people write in. The first person to write in by email was Benjamin Smith. So thank you, Benjamin. And Joe Gass was the first person to write in by Twitter. And I hope, Joe, I am pronouncing your name the right way. Every time I see it, I try to say it to myself in my head, and I hope I'm saying it properly.
G-A-S-Z.
Yes.
And an anonymous person contacted us by phone.
Yes, that is correct. And a woman contacted us by phone. Well, several people contacted us by phone, but the first person was anonymous, or at least didn't leave their name. Of course, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com, and that's what Benjamin wrote into. And Joe followed us on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our Twitter handle. And our anonymous caller called 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. So numerous ways to tell us that we've completely messed up.
So thanks to them and everyone who contacted us, and hopefully we'll get the right show up this week, and what will they be hearing about when they do?
Well, Michael, according to a post on Deadline, this year's pilot casting season has seen an explosion of ethnic and racial minority castings, thanks to the success of new shows like How to Get Away with Murder, Blackish, Fresh Off the Boat, Jane the Virgin, and of course, you know the show I'm going to say, Michael, Empire. We'll take a look at what's going on and what's happening there. Meanwhile, the movie Nightcrawler was a big winner at the IRIS this past weekend. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the IRIS, well, you must be one of our newer listeners. Michael will fill us in on all the winners from the awards this exclusive movie club hands out each year. He knows because he's one of the club's members.
Now I feel like I'm bald, the way it says that. And he's not just a president, he's a member.
Oh, okay. I don't know if our international listeners will understand that. That's a hair club for men joke.
There you go.
I'm not just the president of the hair club for men. I'm also a member or whatever the... Anyway, the Library of Congress, meanwhile, they added some new audio recordings to their registry, which reminds me, Michael, I have to send them all the episodes of Showbiz Sandbox so they can be saved in perpetuity.
You should.
And by the way, in perpetuity is Anglo-French for a really long time, in case you were wondering what that meant.
I wasn't.
Okay. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, not just North America. We get our information from RentTrak, and we have their link in our show notes. We also pull info from The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, The LA Times, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, put it all together, and this is what we come up with, the number one movie around the world. It's good news for DreamWorks Animation because the movie is home. It opened to $78 million this weekend. It's in 65 territories. It opened in a few last week, so it's now past the $100 million mark. An excellent start for the movie. It did really well here in North America. It's doing well everywhere it played. It's getting, you know, mixed reviews, but audiences are flocking to it. There's no new family animated film for quite a few weeks, so it's got a wide open path to profitability. So they only have one movie this year, but at least, thank God, it looks like it's going to be a success.
And it's actually the highest grossing opening for a DreamWorks Animation movie since DreamWorks moved from Paramount to 20th Century Fox, and that includes How to Train Your Dragon 2.
Hmm. Maybe it was Fox that was the problem.
No, I don't know. I can't put a finger on that. I'm not going to point fingers there. But okay. I will say that at least for DreamWorks Animation, it's their highest opening at Fox.
Yeah, and it's $54 million here in North America. Excellent per screen average, the highest in the top 20, I think. And just a success on every level.
Yes, except critically.
That's right. At number two around the world is Cinderella, the Kenneth Branagh live-action reboot. $56 million worldwide. It's blown past the $300 million mark, so this is well into profitability. It's at $336 million and counting. Now comes a movie we can debate. It's the latest film in the Divergent series. It's called Insurgent. It dropped about 50% worldwide, but that's a confusing thing to talk about because you never know what new territories are still to come. But it is in 82 territories right now. It grossed $50 million. That's about half of what it made last weekend. And its worldwide total is $180 million. Now, in North America, there's no question this movie is not doing well.
Well, right? Is it not doing well?
It's dropped 60% this weekend. It's at $86 million. It's going to make less money than the first movie made. That's not what you want to see in a series. At the very least, you want to match the first one. And it cost $110 million to make. So it's falling hard and fast in North America. Overseas, the story's a little different, isn't it?
Well, yeah, overseas, even the first one did, the first week it opened bigger than the first film. I don't know what I'm talking about today, FYI.
I don't know either. The movie is tracking better. The studio keeps making the argument in various countries doing better than the first film, which, you know, they didn't know the books as well. So that makes sense. Just like Twilight, they were introducing the whole series to people. There wasn't a built-in audience, and you want the sequel hopefully to build a little bit. In this case, they insist it's doing better. However, the dollar is so strong that the money they're actually taking in has been pressed down a little bit. It's not as high as it would be because the dollar is too strong. So even if you're making a lot of money in rubles or lira, it's just not translating that well back into U.S. dollars. So worldwide, this movie is at $180 million. They insist it will do better than the first film when all is said and done.
Now, a couple points here. I'm going to start with the last thing you said. In regards to the dollar, very often in countries such as, say, Argentina or Russia or...
Well, Argentina is a very rare case.
Well, they don't take the money out. So
that's a very rare case.
It's not. You'd be surprised. Very often they're not taking money out of those territories because
Japan, England, Germany, France, Spain.
Believe it or not, in
Canada.
In the Eurozone, they are probably keeping their money in euros. Because, you know, it's worth more than the dollar, so there's no reason to take it out.
Well, you're confusing profits with, like, how you store your money to get the most out of it. I mean, that's just not – I mean, you make it sound like they're never going to get the money. I mean, if you decide to keep your money in gold rather than real estate, it doesn't mean you don't have a lot of money.
That's a good idea.
I mean, it's just a technical –
I'm going to do that.
It's just a technical thing.
Well,
the dollar is strong. They're making less money in each country in terms of U.S. dollars because the money isn't worth as much.
Right, but if you never take it out and turn it into dollars,
then
it doesn't
you never
matter.
Have profits.
Well,
what
okay.
do you mean? They have to take it out eventually.
Now, what I will also say is that
they fund movies other overseas, whatever. Yeah, they can leave money in certain territories because then they use the euro to invest in production in movies that stay in that. Why bring it back into the U.S., pay a penalty, and then put it back out again? It's all part of being an international business. None of that changes the fact that they're making less in terms of U.S. dollars because. The dollar is so strong. So, you know, they're not, the tickets are cheaper and therefore they're making less money. And so the money, even if they keep it there, isn't worth as much as it would be and otherwise.
Well, also, I would like to point out that $54 million is what Divergent opened to. And that's also, isn't that what Insurgent opened to? $54 million?
Well, you're looking at worldwide and it's opened already. It opened last weekend in some places. So it's not a.
No. In the U.S. And it dropped 53% in North America. The first film dropped 53%, not 50%, and earned $25 million. So it's earning a little less, but not by much.
What did the first film end up making?
First film ended up making
in North America
$150 million in North America alone.
This movie's not going to get to $150 million.
It may not. I would agree.
Before this movie opened, they were saying, oh my God, it's tracking better. People are loving it. They can't wait to see it. It opened lower than the first one. It's probably going to end up significantly lower, I would imagine. I mean, it is at $86 million. It's not going to double that. It just dropped 60% this week, but we'll see. It's still in 10, what is it? 8 digits. Is that what the $10 million mark is? 7 digits is a million, 8 digits. Yeah. So it's still, you know, over 20 million bucks this weekend. So we'll see, but I think trying to put a happy spin on this is not working for me. And number four is Get Hard, the Will Ferrell, Kevin Hart comedy. $39 million it opened up to worldwide. That's in 10 territories. And it opened at number, what was it, 2?
This weekend
it was behind Home, the animated film. So most of its money was made here in North America. It made $35 million in the U.S. So another success for Kevin Hart. First hit in a little while, I would think, for Will Ferrell. He hasn't actually been in my mind's eye, he hasn't been very present lately.
No, I can't remember the last film. Although, given to the way I am today, I can't remember anything. So don't ask me.
Well, at number five is Kingsman: The Secret Service. It opened in China, which is where it just hauled in a bunch of money. They loved it. It made $20 million in that territory alone. So its worldwide take is $28 million, well past $300 million. It's now at $330 million. Still, we're waiting for them to announce a sequel. At number six is the Will Smith film Focus. Another $10 million. It's at $135 million worldwide. It is in 63 territories, so it could have another 20 to go. I don't know if there are big markets like China or Japan to go. We'll have to see where it ends up. It's going to triple its budget, but given the fact that Will Smith is involved, we really want to see it quadruple its budget in order to say, yes, this was a success.
Now, I know somebody's going to write in and say Will Ferrell was in the Lego movie. His voice was in the Lego movie.
That's fair enough, but that's not a film where I don't think he was a draw.
No.
You know, you don't. I'm not that actors can't be draws in animated films, but I don't think that was a case of that. I think Tom Hanks and Tim Allen were absolutely draws, even to the first Toy Story movie. People knew they were involved and they were interested and excited to hear them.
Right.
In this case, I don't think that's true.
And actually, that film, Toy Story, was one of the kind of spark plugs, if you will. It started the whole celebrity. I didn't start it, but it helped kick it off in the modern age.
Did it?
Yes.
Every Disney film in history practically has, you know, I mean, I don't know, really?
On that level, yes, where you had A-list movie stars doing them.
Okay.
Write into dirt@showbizsandbox.com and prove me wrong. I'm just trying to say things that will make people write in, I suppose.
Well, that's the way to go. Yeah, I mean, before Get Hard, the last big
Anchorman
2,
yeah.
You know, which you know, and then The Internship, which was, yeah, it was just a cameo, then the campaign. Yeah, he's been sort of not very visible lately. I don't know what's been going on. Maybe he's got a lot of projects in the works. All right, at number seven is 20. This is a South Korean comedy. It grossed $7 million over the weekend. It's at $8 million and counting. It's about three young guys. They all just turned 20 and they're best pals and they're facing the future. One guy's a ladies' man. One guy's really shy but wants a corporate job. And the third guy wants to be a cartoonist, but he has to take a corporate job to help his family out. I didn't know anything about the movie. I looked it up. I didn't know the actors. I looked all of them up. Each one is prettier than the next. They don't even look like real people. So all the young ladies are going to go see this movie. At number eight is Taken 3. That's at $330 million worldwide. SpongeBob SquarePants is moving along. That's going to hit the $300 million mark. We had talked last week about Lost and Love, which is a Chinese drama about a dad, Andy Lau, trying to track down his missing son. That's at $31 million and counting. Second best exotic Marigold Hotel is at number 11. I feel like this movie is playing like a classic sequel.
Why?
I mean,
is that?
These days, you know, all these sequels, they're part of series. They build bigger than the first. You sort of had these crazy expectations. It used to be, if you made a sequel, and like when I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s or the 60s, the expectation was the first movie made money, you made a sequel, that would make about two-thirds of what the first made, and it would cost a little bit more. And then the third one, if you made one, would make a little bit less than that. Because it was sort of diminishing returns. That's how a lot of series worked back in the old days. That's how sequels worked. Nowadays, you know, it's one long story. And for a lot of different reasons, people expect the movies to all make the same amount of money, if not more. That's why we're talking about Divergent and Insurgent. If Insurgent makes less than Divergent, well, that would be pretty normal in historical terms. So here's the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. It's at $68 million worldwide. And you know what? It's probably going to make less than the original, and it costs a little bit more to make, but it's still going to be profitable. And that's how the thing used to work. No?
I guess, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
no, I have no idea what I'm talking about.
No, I do, but I don't have anything to add.
You've
said it all. The one thing didn't point out, though, is that you have Cinderella, right? You have you have Home, and these are two family films. They've both made over $150 million. Right?
You mean worldwide box office?
Worldwide box office. You have SpongeBob, also over $150 million. No, at the domestic box office.
Oh, you mean and counting box office-wise?
Yeah. I mean, you...
Well, I mean Home has not made $150 million yet. It's at $100 million.
Sorry, yes, that's true.
But it will. It will absolutely make $100. It'll blow past that. Okay. So you're saying these... you're talking about worldwide box office, that these family films are all scoring highly?
Yes. Which is good, I think, because that means that you have all of these youngsters, they're going to the movie theater, and we're getting them in the habit of actually going to the cinema, and that's really, really good for the long run.
Sure, though, I mean, you know, 1 weekend or 4 films in a row does not a trend make, you know. But absolutely, it's always good when you have a good mix of films. I would say Cinderella tracks a little higher than a family film. It's probably more older teens and adults than kids. I don't think little kids are rushing to see Cinderella. It's a romance about, you know. It's unlike the animated film. I don't think it has the same kiddie appeal.
Even better, because as long as you have people under the age of 20 or 25 going to the movies as entertainment, that's a good habit to get them into.
Well, I bet some of them, the ones who are in high school and college, went to see It Follows. This is a horror film. It's from the Radius arm, I think, of the Weinstein Company. And it's going to look like it's going to be their top grossing film of all time from that little particular label. It expanded this weekend, making $4 million. The total is $7.7 million and counting. This is like practically one of those movies that looks like it would be a straight to DVD or streaming video on demand type of movie. Maybe you'd open in a few theaters to fill out some contract. But in this case, when they made the film, they realized they liked it and it was good. And so they were prepared for more. So they opened it up on some screens. They got excellent reviews, especially for a horror film. And so they expanded it wide to like 1,100 screens. And they're saying, we're going to make money on this. We want this movie is going to be more profitable on DVD and streaming video by not going day and date. That's not always the smart thing to do. And they're saying, hey, you know, it's not one size fits all. When you've got a movie and it's got great reviews and it's getting great word of mouth, which is what they're arguing for, they say, hey, capitalize on that. And that doesn't always mean putting it in people's homes right away.
Right. So they delayed the VOD in this case. Mm-hmm. And this got great reviews out of Sundance. This was a Sundance 2015 entry for Park City at Midnight. People loved it there, so mm-hmm. It makes sense that it kind of follows through to the actual theatrical audience.
Right. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with opening a movie streaming video on demand or day and date and all that stuff that they do all the time. But there's no reason not to be smart and say, hey, every movie's a little different, and how can we make the most money when you've got something that is getting great word of mouth and really good reviews. Maybe the best way to capitalize it is to keep it in theaters a little bit longer. Now, they expanded it, 1,100 screens. It only made $3,300 per screen. So it's not a great per screen average, but they're convinced that next week, It Follows will do just as well in North America. They think it's going to have a great hold and build its audience. So we'll have to see where that ends up. But that's the worldwide box office from RentTrak and everybody else.
Well, I guess we could also find that worldwide box office on IMDb.
Can you?
I don't know. That was my way of getting us into this story about IMDb. I guess they continue to win their lawsuit. I guess they were sued, right? So it's not their lawsuit. They were sued by Junie Hwang, who was and is an actress who signed up for IMDb Pro, provided her real age, which IMDb then actually...
No, she didn't. No. She provided a fake age, birth date. They did a public record search and... as they would do for everybody, and they saw her real birthday. They didn't put that in the database. That's the whole issue.
Oh, now I get it. Okay.
Maybe she did it in the back room or something. She gave the real age. But yeah, I mean, my understanding, whatever the facts is, it's an age discrimination lawsuit. She says, hey, I'm an actress. I have to lie about my age or I'm going to lose work. And she was furious that IMDb posted her actual age. They said, well, we just did a public record, you know, just because you're have a membership, a professional, you know, registration on IMDb doesn't mean we're willing to lie about your age. We saw what your actual age was, and so that's what we put. Our database needs to be accurate. And she's like, well, that's not right. You know, you took advantage of me because I provided my credit card info and other stuff. You were able to see that what my real age was, and you shouldn't have used that information in the way you did. Went to court. She lost every step of the way. It's just been overseen by the Ninth Circuit, and they looked at the case and said that there's no a reason for a reversal. So they have let the ruling stand. And it looks like that'll be it. It won't get to the Supreme Court because there's no lower court conflict. One court ruling one way and other courts ruling another way. So there's really nothing for them to resolve.
Yeah, no, I would be surprised if somehow this wound up in the Supreme Court.
But it raises, interesting information. I mean, can you expect a website to lie about facts for you? You know, he's like, no, I know that's not my age, but I want you to put that. Is that a reasonable expectation? I would think not. Not that they need to necessarily search out the truth, but if they happen to see it or know it, then continuing to lie about it is a bizarre thing to expect a website to do or any source of information.
Right. And I guess there's also the question of what private information, and I guess maybe a birthday or an age is not private, but for instance, during the St. Louis Ferguson riots, the New York Times
protests
protests. Yes, there were some news outlets that published the officer who was involved in the shooting of the suspect. They published his home address, and that was, did they go too far? I would say
I don't know why they would publish his home address as such, but now that some cities and states are looking at laws saying that you have to wait like 60 days before you identify the officer, reveal that, you know, release that information, I don't know where the right to know balances between the right to, make sure somebody is safe and protect them. There's no reason why they should remain anonymous, can you keep it secret if somebody's been fired for embezzlement and you just don't want to announce who it was? It's news. It happened. Person's shot. How long can you keep that information secret when the media has access to it? It's a difficult balance.
Now, you probably had a difficult balance over the past, a week or so, as you were a member of the IRA committee there?
That's right. The IRA Awards, it's the 40th anniversary of this group that's been gathering since 1970, I think early 1977, where they voted on the best films of 1976. So they've been doing it for almost my entire life. I joined when I met one of the members at Premiere Magazine, and he invited me to take part. And I've been doing it for a long time now, like 20 years, over 20 years. And it's great. They get together, they debate, and they give their awards in all the categories, just like the Oscars and
now,
the New York
Who
Film
is the
Critics.
They? Let's kind of identify who they are.
Well, it's a rotating group of people over the years. Obviously, people come in and then they leave. But
they're not just like people off the street. These are people either working professionally in the entertainment industry.
Right. They started as a group of friends studying film in college here in New York City. And so now they've gone on, some of them, to become Oscar-winning filmmakers, best-selling biographers like Ed Sykov, who did a biography of Billy Wilder, which is the best in the field, and he's done Betty Davis and a lot of other people, but the Billy Wilder book was perhaps his crowning achievement on Sunset Boulevard. Playwrights, film publicists at major studios, film execs, obviously critics and schmucks like me, freelance journalists, academics and scholars, and just plain old film buffs. But, a lot of people who are in the industry, but they're not members of guilds, and so they weren't voting for all these different things. They're like, well, heck, we can do a better job. And they're all hardcore movie buffs. I mean, these guys are picking, Armenian yak films. They're picking
documentaries. I know the film you're talking about.
They're picking films that are, they love international films. They love classic Hollywood. And so, every year we get together, you pick the best movies of the year. And every other year we vote on something like the best movies of the 60s. Where we have a complicated process. Everybody pitches in their 100 movies. We get a big ballot. We rank them. And then the big night, we debate over who should be in what category. And we end up with our list. So that's what we did. And this year, the big winner was Nightcrawler, which is a terrific film by Dan Gilroy. And this is why we do the list. They tend not to nominate the same movies or pick the same movies that won the Oscars and swept everything else. Normally, it's just not their taste. They like better films than that. But sometimes if there's overlap, they will do it. But by and large, they want to bring attention to movies that have been overlooked. And so Nightcrawler is a great film. It really should have been in the mix at the end of the year. Jake Gyllenhaal really should have been nominated for Best Actor. Rene Russo should have won Best Supporting Actress. It just feels like an Oscar performance. But it was pretty much overlooked, and if you haven't seen it, you should check it out. Nightcrawler won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, and a number of tech awards. So that was really cool to see. And Best Actress was Essie Davis from The Babadook. There's a horror film for you. Did you see that movie, Sperling?
I've seen most of it. I haven't seen it. I'm not a big horror fan.
Neither am I, but it's not a particularly, it's more a suspense than gory,
Yes, yes. So I saw, I would say the first 45 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So our Best Supporting Actor, and this is where we bob and weave. Everybody was picking Patricia Arquette for Boyhood. We picked Ethan Hawke for Best Supporting Actor, and it was a terrific performance and deserved not to be overlooked. And Best Supporting Actress, we picked Agata Kuletsa, an actress for Ida, which is a Polish film by Paweł Pawlowski, who's a terrific director. And so, you look at our list. We've got a link in the show notes. And if there's a movie you haven't seen, it might be worth checking out. Our top five movies were Nightcrawler, Foxcatcher, a French film called Stranger by the Lake, Boyhood, and Ida. So those are all definitely worth your time.
I definitely like the Sominex Award going to Monuments Men.
Yeah, the Sominex Award is for our award for the movie that put us to sleep. And that was the Monuments Men. And then the movie that made us sick, the Dramamine Award, was The Imitation Game, which we objected to for countless historical and artistic reasons.
Well, and I would like to point out the what did you say, the Armenian Yak movie that you're talking about?
Just off the top of my head. It was just a joke.
I know. It was actually a movie from Kazakhstan in 2008 named Tulpan.
I never saw it. I just was making that up.
I know.
Maybe they don't even have yaks in Armenia. I shouldn't say that.
Yeah, so Tulpan, T-U-L-P-A-N. It's an interesting movie, that film.
Well, and we also did the best movies of the 60s. The top 10 would certainly be some of the classics that you would expect. Our favorite film was Psycho, then The Apartment by Billy Wilder, that director that one of our members wrote a really great biography about. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance by John Ford, 2001 by Kubrick, and Chimes at Midnight by Orson Welles, which is just being restored. It's very exciting news because I've seen that movie, but never in a good print. And you really can't enjoy a movie when it's not in a good print. Looking at the top 20 films of the 60s, Sperling, how many haven't you seen? Which one of them haven't you seen?
Wow. That's actually When a Woman Ascends the Stairs, I have not seen.
A terrific film by Mikio Nerus, yes.
I would say Andrei Rublev, I have not seen.
Tarkovsky, yeah. All right. So that's pretty good. You've seen 18 out of the top 20.
Yes. What I would point out, here's something. What do many of these films, not all, but what do many of these films have in common?
I don't know.
Saul Bass did the poster for many of them. Psycho,
well,
he
worked with Hitchcock, so he did Psycho, Marnie, and The Birds, sure.
And Bunny Lake is Missing.
Right, Otto Preminger, yeah. No, so, he was in his heyday in the 60s.
That's right.
So that's very cool. So we have a link in our show notes. You can check out the entire list. You can check out all the nominees and winners for all the categories for this year and all 100 films that we named as the best of the 60s. Some of them I hate, a lot of them I love, some of my favorites are missing, but that's the point of a list.
Really? I thought a point of a list was that you didn't forget your socks when you were packing.
That too.
Okay, well, you know, speaking of which, did we forget to mention there was no show next week?
Oh, we did. That's right. It's your fault.
But, you know, we did.
I mean, it's your fault we didn't mention it, and it's your fault there will be no show next week.
That's true, but at least we did it at the halfway mark. Is that that's better than doing it in
that's
the last five and
nothing.
A half? Yeah.
Why will there not be a show next week, Sperling?
Because it's spring break, so I'm going to Fort Lauderdale to, it's spring break, so my kids are off, and we are going on vacation.
To where?
To the British Virgin Islands.
Can we give the address out to the folks in the world?
You could, but it'll be on a boat, so that address will be changing on a regular basis.
Well, you know, my dad lived in the American Virgin Islands and had a hotel there for a little while.
Really? What was the name of the hotel?
I forget. It might have been just a restaurant. I'm forgetting now. Well, I was never there while he was there.
Okay.
Ended up that the guy that he was partnered with was a drug runner.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was like, wow, there's a lot of bales in that boat. Whoops. Seriously. So I've never been to the American Virgin Islands, but my dad lived there for like a couple of years. My sister was there a little bit. So have fun. I guess they don't have Wi-Fi there. That's a shame.
No, they don't have Wi-Fi there. As a matter of fact, I have spent the better part of many, many hours trying to figure out how to get Wi-Fi while on a boat in the Virgin Islands.
On a boat. Oh, because they have Wi-Fi in the Virgin Islands.
Yes.
And boats can have Wi-Fi. You just got to have a satellite hookup.
That's true. Although
it's expensive.
Yes, exactly.
You're going to be bailing. You don't have time for Wi-Fi. Well, all right.
Exactly.
So no show next week. That's
no show next week. But, you know, you made a list of the best films of the 60s. The Library of Congress makes its own lists. They have so many lists, they don't even know where to put them all.
That's right. And it's a list of, you know, classic recordings. And again, just like the film registry, these are not necessarily like the absolute best. They're significant in one way or another. A lot of them are, of course, tremendously good, but they're also just significant for various reasons. And it's kind of a fascinating list. I could really spend an hour talking about them. But do you know, the first thing on the list that I saw was a radio episode. It's called Sorry, Wrong Number, starring Agnes Moorehead, and it aired on Suspense. On May 25th, 1943, that's the first time they did it because it was a smash hit and they did it again and again and again. Are you familiar with this episode? Have you ever heard it?
I have seen the movie.
Well, yeah, that's not the same because it's a radio play. And Orson Welles, who should know, he was a genius in radio, said this was the greatest radio script of all time.
And he loved Agnes Moorehead.
Well, who doesn't?
Yeah. Now the movie version of this, I saw in Bryant Park, okay, in the early, well, I would say late 90s. Okay. And I had just gotten my first mobile phone, my first cell phone. And in the middle of the movie, it starts ringing. And I'm thinking, who could possibly be calling this brand new phone that I have? I pick up the phone and it's somebody who's asking for insert name of somebody I don't even know.
Schmidlmeier.
I said, oh, I'm sorry, you have the wrong number.
Ah!
Then literally everybody around me started laughing.
Well, you know, this is the cool thing. We've got the list of the Library of Congress. You can find it anywhere. And almost all of it is available online. I mean, some of the recent classic albums, no, but a lot of them you'll find. We've got a link in our show notes to YouTube where that episode of Sorry Wrong Number is posted. So that's kind of cool. You know, if you're wondering what it's like, check it out. It's a really great play.
And you have, I know you don't want to go down this whole list. You got The Doors,
Well, I'd love
Radiohead.
To, but we don't have time.
So,
okay, Computer.
Yeah, which ones do you want to point out here?
Well, I would say that the two that I don't think belong very quickly is, I don't think The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill will stand the test of time. I don't think she's just not made music. I don't think the Fugees have remained interesting. I just don't think that album is really one that should be enshrined there. And I'd say the same thing for Steve Martin's A Wild and Crazy Guy. I own the album. That's the one with King Tut on it. It's got the Nonconformist Oath, which is pretty damn funny, where you get thousands of people in the audience to repeat after me, I promise to be unique. I promise not to repeat things other people say. And I just don't think Steve Martin is an album guy. I feel like he really worked visually, as a lot of stand-ups do, and I don't think his albums are that significant.
Well, he would disagree with you, especially when he's holding a banjo.
musically, yeah, of course. But I think, like, if there was a live concert version of Steve Martin or one of his HBO specials, I think that would be more worthy of saving than this audio version of that album. But that's just me. But I do think You've Lost That Love and Feeling is interesting. That's a single by the Righteous Brothers. Ooh, I know what my first reaction was when I saw it on the list. What was yours, Sperling?
Oh,
why wasn't it on the list already?
Oh, that's on the list? Yeah, that one did not stand out to me.
Yes. Well, you know, the funny thing about this is it's one of many songs, apparently. The more I read about old popular music, you know, DJs did not want to play songs that were long.
That's
they didn't
right.
want to do it. They didn't have time. They wouldn't play a song that was over 4 minutes
As Billy
long.
Joel said, if you want to make a hit, you got to make it quick. Can you cut it down to 3:05?
Exactly. And so You've Lost That Love and Feeling was labeled as being 3:05. They just lied. It ran over 4 minutes long. And DJs, of course, had to time things, but they didn't care. They just slapped it on the label and lied about the time. And this happens a lot. I mean, a lot. But like Phil Spector did it, I think, on River Deep Mountain High. People would say 3:65, you know. So you just see the three and think, oh, okay, it's under 4 minutes. And this is a bizarre thing to me, but it was happening, you know, every once in a while when you had a great song and it was over 4 minutes and you wanted DJs to play it, you lied to them.
And thus the song Piano Man.
That's right.
By Billy Joel. Yeah. Which is why I was referencing
Kiss Me Kate significant? This is the original cast album from the Broadway show Kiss Me Kate, written by Cole Porter.
Okay.
Why is it significant?
Well, isn't it I know it was a Columbia record, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. And it's the first cast album to come out on the LP format. So when you're looking, when you're talking about, you know, classic work, and of course show tunes and cast albums were huge in the 40s and the 50s into the 60s. You know, that they were big blockbuster bestsellers. Not everybody got to Broadway, but they could all buy an LP, couldn't they? And this was rushed out into stores 5 weeks after it opened, so that's kind of amazing. And the show, of course, starred Alfred Drake and Patricia Morrison. Patricia Morrison just turned 100, so happy birthday, Patricia.
Well, and I love all these wax cylinder recordings. Those are the ones that stand out to me, that like, A, they still have them. B, they can still access them. That's the, like, where do you have a wax cylinder player?
Yeah, I've had friends who've given me some Edison wax cylinders that I have. I can't play them, though.
Right.
So they're very cool. They're kind of heavy. They're kind of neat. And sometimes they have the cardboard thing that they came in. So that's pretty cool. And the Vernacular Wax Cylinder Recordings, this is a collection at the University of California in Santa Barbara in their library. They go from the 1890s to the 1910s. And what's cool about this is these are literally like home recordings. It's like, you know how you're probably too young, I don't know. When I was a kid, people would like make cassette tape audio recordings of stuff. Like my mom taped my birthday party 1 year and you'd make letters to people, but you would just talk to them and then you'd mail them the cassette and they'd mail it back. It was a sort of a, you know, thing people did. They had the ability suddenly to record stuff in their home pretty cheaply and easily. Well, this started in the 1890s. So these are like just regular Joes making recordings of themselves, which is kind of amazing, like Elvis walking into that booth and recording a song. And so there'd just be like random stuff like jokes or ad-libs or sounds of babies crying. There's a barnyard animals on one of these discs. It's like the first recording of an animal. like in the world, you know, as far as they can tell. So it's just kind of a cool, raw human document. It's like taking home movies from people and realizing those are worth archiving. Not all of them, but as far as a representative of what people were doing. And so it's really cool. And again, we got a link in our show notes. If you want to go, you can listen to them. I think that's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool, actually. I was wondering if you could do that.
Yeah. And so we were talking about how the You've Lost That Love and Feeling was an example of record labels lying to DJs to try and trick them into playing their long song. And there's another classic tradition, and it's sort of exemplified by 16 Tons, which is a classic country song by Tennessee Ernie Ford. And this was the B-side.
This is the first B-side that became a hit. Yeah.
Well, this was the B-side. I forget what the A-side was. No one's heard of it. Nobody cares. But it's a classic example where the DJs played a song and go, they turn it over and they go, I like the B-side. And it was just, you know, he was just snapping his fingers and created the song. They sort of did it off the cuff. And that, of course, became the hit. And that's a great example of how hits get discovered by DJs. You know, it's not like today where it's all just automated and you got a voice saying stuff. They were people who had taste and personality, and they helped make songs hits.
Which I guess would have been a big deal at the time.
That's right, because it is time for Big Deal, Big Whoop, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Michael, you said we were going to be mentioning this, and of course we are. The new host of The Daily Show is Trevor Noah, to which the world said, yeah, who? Indeed, Noah makes James Corden look like Madonna in terms of high profile. James Corden, of course, here in the U.S., took over the late show for Craig Ferguson. So
that's right.
Yeah. He's a South African comic. He has experience hosting a show, and he's been a rather low profile contributor to The Daily Show, having appeared on the air a sum total of, get this, Michael, actually means there's hope for us, three times he's been on the air.
Well, since we've been on the show zero times, I don't know what hope we have.
That's a good point. Now he's being thrown into the deep end in what is surely one of the biggest gambles of the year. There's no telling how he might reshape the show because we have essentially no idea what he's like. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for Comedy Central. You said it before the show. Isn't like he won the part or, you know, was chosen from thousands. How did you phrase it?
He was the last man standing. It was like, okay, so everybody else is left.
I guess we'll take that guy.
Yeah, you in the corner over here. Because I actually, when I was going through in my mind who was left, Jessica Williams, right? Asif Manvi and Trevor Noah were like the only people I could think of. And I thought, well, I can't imagine they'd go with Trevor Noah. I just didn't see it.
Asif Manvi, of course, has a flourishing acting career, and maybe he wasn't interested. I don't know. Jessica Williams, at least publicly pulled herself out of the running and said, you know, I'm not ready to do that. I haven't done that yet. I don't have the experience. Trevor Noah has hosted a show in South Africa, so he does have some experience behind the desk, as you would put it. I've never even seen his appearances on the show. Of course, he'll open and he'll be terrible. And then 6 months from now, we'll find out if he's any good. You know, he's got to put his own stamp on the show. But he does have an international perspective. I don't know why that's important for a comedy show set in North America, but he does. He speaks six languages. He's traveled all over the world. Who knows what he'll bring to the show? Who knows what he'll do? Jon Stewart completely transformed it from Craig Kilborn. And he said, hey, look, Trevor is exactly where I was at when they gave me this show. And that's, of course, not true. But the more important thing is that the show was not what it was then. At the time, it was nothing and nobody cared about it. Jon Stewart turned it into the biggest show in television in some ways, certainly in terms of comedy. So, you know, it's a much bigger platform now, and it's going to be a big spotlight on Trevor Noah. So, you know, you wish him luck. Hope he's good.
You know, I've seen his three performances or three, I guess.
Skits or whatever. Yeah,
his three appearances, I guess, would be. And the first time he was on, I thought, oh, my goodness, they must be reaching the bottom of the barrel to pull out, you know, because he was so stiff. And so nervous. I thought, oh, my God, it was just completely off. Even Jon Stewart at the time, this was back in December, he was trying to help him. He was like trying to throw him a rope.
I didn't think a lot of people don't do great their first time out. They got to get their footing. I didn't think Jessica Williams was very good the first bunch of times I saw her. I didn't think she was going to last. But she's grown in confidence, and I think she's you just got to do it. And I think she's good now. So, you know, we'll see where he ends up.
Well, you have Trevor Noah getting a job, and then you have other people leaving. The boy band One Direction is now one less. Get it? Because it's One Direction.
I do.
Okay, yeah. Remember, Zayn Malik has pulled out for good, releasing this statement. This is what he said. I am leaving because I want to be a normal 22-year-old who is able to relax and have some private time out of the spotlight. What was he thinking? Malik is one of the less cute members of One Direction. Let's just kind of put it that way. I mean, he's cute, but he's not cute. I'd kiss him, but he's not like, you know, I'd take him to the prom or anything. Wait, what am I saying? What the heck am I saying? The rest of the band will continue as a foursome. See, now even that sounds wrong. Who wrote this stuff? Anyway, that foursome will... Wait, I keep saying it. Well, they're going to record their next album in the fall. Do I need to sit down and have a talk with you know, Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Well, you know, that's a spoof, of course, of the Hunger Games review that was on The Onion. We have a link in our show notes. If you haven't seen that, it's one of the funniest reviews. I keep watching it because it's so hilarious. But it's very, very funny where he talks about the two guys in the movie. He's cute, but he's not that cute. And it really is kind of a classic bit of taped comedy. So we have a link to that in our show notes. This is, you know, it is big news. I mean, the band's staying together. There's five of them and now there's four. To me, did not have the strongest identity in the band. So I think if you're looking at all five of them, if there's one you'd say that was the most disposable or the one that you would suffer the least if he disappeared, I would say it probably was Zayn Malik. So, you know, it's not like it was, you know, one of the big guys. So, you know, they will soldier on.
And by the way, congratulations, you're going to be a normal 22-year-old. You are now jobless.
He'll be okay, I think.
Yeah. Now, what I loved is after this announcement was made, there was a flurry of requests to employers, British employers, for people asking to take time off for compassionate leave because they were so upset that Zayn Malik had quit. And there were all these news stories where this consulting firm had been called by all these employers saying, well, I don't know, what do we do? Are we supposed to allow for this to, you know, should we allow this? Are we going to get in trouble if we don't allow it? And, you know, the consulting firm said, no, it's not like, unless their last name is Malik, they don't get off.
I'm sure nobody got off.
No.
That's classic British media.
Exactly. It was on the BBC for Pete's sake.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so Malik doesn't have a job. However, we have a story about somebody who does have a job. Can you call a classical music conductor a rock star? I guess you can, right? It certainly fits Gustavo Dudamel, who has extended his contract with the Los Angeles Philharmonic through 2021-22, so all the way through 2022. His contract wasn't set to expire until 2019, but the deal got done now for several reasons. One, the classical music and opera worlds plan their schedules literally years in advance. Talk to any opera singer and they can probably tell you their commitments through 2017. Two, Dudamel also leads the Simon Bolivar Symphony Orchestra in Venezuela, but he's proven a big draw in LA and he's on everyone's shortlist as one of the top conductors worldwide. With both the New York Philharmonic and the Berlin Philharmonic looking to find a conductor in the next few years, it was thought wise to commit to Dudamel in a big way here in Los Angeles. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. I mean, it's a big deal for the other people who need a big name to fill big slots. But, you know, he was there at L.A. He's staying put. They were smart. They were proactive. And everybody's happy. But tell me, Spellman, what's the difference between a philharmonic and an orchestra?
Oh, please don't ask me this question. One starts with a P and one starts with an O.
That's right, actually. There is no difference.
Yes.
It's just in cities where there's two of them, people started the tradition of one was, you know, the New York Orchestra and the other one would be the New York Symphony or the New York Philharmonic. And there's really no difference between, you know, between the names. It's just a way of distinguishing between two or more in the same city.
Well, a couple points here as somebody who lives in Los Angeles. Dudamel took over for Esa-Pekka Salonen, who was the music director and conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic for years up until 2009. And it was a good orchestra then. I think what makes this kind of a big deal is that it kind of seals LA's and the LA Philharmonic's place in and standing in classical music, at least current classical music.
We're a real musical force. That's right. What you're saying.
Exactly. The kind of professional relationship between Deborah Borda. I can't pronounce that name for some reason. Deborah Borda is the LA Phil president. And has been, she got Dudamel here, and, you know, their kind of partnership at the LA Phil is really well known in classical music. So well known, in fact, that it's supposedly the, what's the word I'm looking for?
Driving force. The
driving
reason?
Force. The inspiration for Mozart in the Jungle. The relationship of the main character played by, why am I, I'm losing my mind today, Michael. I can't.
Gael Garcia Bernal.
Yes, thank you. And Bernadette Peters, who plays.
Right, and that's an, is that an Amazon series?
It is Amazon an Amazon Prime? Series. It's yeah. very fun. That I think Bernal in that role, he plays kind of a Dudamel with the hair and the, he's hilarious.
Well, have you seen him perform? Is he good? Do you like him as leading of the orchestra?
Oh, yeah, you can totally tell. He basically gets it. He's like, look, you're coming here and anybody can be standing up here waving their arms. Well, why not have, you know,
what?
Somebody who's interesting and you know, really into it. And he is like a rock star.
But no, that's not true. You can't have anybody waving their arms. They work with the orchestra to mold and shape the performance. They work with them intimately. They know that you couldn't go up there and conduct an orchestra. That's not true.
I could poorly.
Yes, you could. All right, moving on.
HBO is doubling down on Vice, which I would think is probably Cinemax's job, isn't it? Now, of course, the Red Hot brand, and I mean youth-friendly umbrella for various video and news reporting, they shopped themselves around but couldn't find the right deal. But just like Dorothy, they realized there's no place like home. At least no place like home box office. They've worked well for HBO, providing content and giving their brand a big boost in legitimacy, along with some substantial long-form journalism. Plus, Vice boasts that the people tuning into Vice News are almost all aged 15 to 34. Now, HBO has made a long-term deal. Vice gets its own dedicated channel on the new OTT service HBO Now. And on the main station, Vice will produce a daily half-hour newscast that should do for the evening news what Chelsea Handler hopes to do to the staid late-night talk show, well, the talk show world, that she hopes to blow it up. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's an interesting deal. I don't think it's a huge deal. I mean, they were working for HBO, but it is kind of funny somebody launching a new daily evening newscast of hard news. What shape will it take? It's on premium cable rather than the three major networks. Everyone sort of sees those as dead and gone and pointless with 24-hour news and with all that stuff. You know, all you see are ads for geriatric stuff because those are the people watching ABC, CBS, and NBC. Here is HBO saying, we think there's a space for regular evening news where people tune in to say, hey, tell us what the most important stuff of the day is, not just tell us what you have video of and tell us what you can cover live because you have a reporter on the scene. So that's, you know, it's going to be interesting. Maybe they can actually shake up real news the way Jon Stewart shaped up, you know, media coverage of the news and politics.
I think that you're right. I think that quite honestly, HBO saw kind of a chink in Comedy Central's armor over the ability to do these like newsertainment. I don't know, whatever the idea of getting news into the hands of millennials through kind of a more accessible means.
Well, The Daily Show is a comedy show. It's not a news show.
That's right. I also think that Vice, you know, some of their reporting is quite good. Don't get me wrong. Even David Carr, the late David Carr, had to eventually concede, hey, they have been doing some good work, but boy, do they go out on a limb sometimes. And I don't mean in terms of the news they're covering. I mean they're
journalistically,
they're putting some people in some really precarious spots. You know, some dangerous situations.
Well, isn't that a journalistic tradition in war zones and all over the world? Cameramen and photographers and journalists. I mean, haven't they been doing that for, you know, a century?
I guess so. Yeah.
To me, the thing I have to say right before this news came out, I happened to have read two different stories, one in Rolling Stone and one somewhere else that cited work by Vice. They were like writing a news story and they said, oh, that's first reported by Vice or as Vice review. I was like, oh, that's the first time I've seen that. So they must. I've never really paid attention to them. I've never really watched them. I certainly don't go on YouTube and watch all the junky little videos that they have, which just seem like a bunch of noise to me. But apparently they're doing some real journalism.
Yeah, no, the train ride into North Korea, that, you know, it's also basically a news network based on Shane Smith, I think, or Sean Smith. I can't remember his name now, but the basically a personality.
Really? I thought it was a bunch of different people.
It is, but it's you know, surrounded by that one guy.
Oh, okay. I didn't know they had a face of Vice News.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, the Vice deal with HBO feels like a bold original move, a daily newscast on a premium cable channel. But Much of the other news coming out of TV, Michael, it feels kind of like reruns. See what we did there? Because it's TV and reruns. You see? Okay. The X-Files, for instance, it's back. It's returning to TV with 6 new episodes, and all the originals are on board. Notably, creator Chris Carter referred to how he looked forward to telling 6 new stories. So these will presumably be standalone tales rather than some extension of the show's convoluted mythology. We already knew about Twin Peaks coming back, and talk of Prison Break keeps heating up. I don't know how they would do that.
Just a new person in a new prison.
That's true. Plus, in a rare sitcom revival, rare if not unprecedented, Craig T. Nelson's old sitcom Coach is coming back. Is it a reboot or a remake? Nope. It's just more episodes starring Craig T. Nelson in the title role again. This time, he'll be the assistant coach to his grown son heading a program at an Ivy League school. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course. You know, shows keep coming back. They always have. They always will. I guess Coach actually is kind of like in the Lucille Ball tradition. I mean, she was always playing Lucy. They'd have a new setting or a new mix-up, but it was always the same old thing. So the Coach show does have a new initial setup, but you know, it's Coach. So, you know, why wouldn't TV feast on its own history? You know, they turn them into movies and Broadway shows. Why not turn them into more TV shows?
Rocker and roller Elvis Costello has always been praised for his literate lyrics. Well, now we're about to find out just how literate he can be. Costello is publishing his memoirs this fall as both a book and, of course, an audiobook he'll read himself. Shouldn't he sing it himself? Anyway, it's called Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. It comes out October 13th and is available for pre-order now on the Penguin website. Big deal or big whoop?
See, that's funny because I would have bet money that you would have made a joke about disappearing ink. That's what I thought. Sprone's going to make a bad joke and say, well, if it's disappearing ink, how can I read the book? Why would I pay good money for a book that disappears?
I thought about doing that, actually. How funny is it?
I bet you did. Two things about this. One, of course, Elvis Costello is a great artist. I almost ran him over in a car once, but I let him go. And I'm excited to read the book. Who knows what kind of shape it'll be. But the other thing is, I think it was it? I saw it in like the Times, I think. Initially, I saw this story. No, it's rollingstone.com. That's where my link is. And they had said, oh, it's available for pre-order on the Penguin website. And they linked to the Penguin website. Historically, that was a very dangerous thing to do. You didn't want to piss off your bookstores. You didn't want to piss off all the people who need to promote the book. And so they didn't really tout their own ability to sell you directly. But nowadays, with Amazon, everything, all bets are off. So publishers would love it if you would come to their site and buy the book, which is essentially at full price rather than discounted on Amazon or somewhere else. But here's what really struck me. I went to look at the link and see how much they were charging. The hardcover is $29.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot.
Right. No, it's not. But when it's on sale, of course, it'll be like $17 or $18. But yeah, if you buy it directly from them, you're paying $29. I didn't even look to see what it is on Amazon. Maybe you can do that while I'm reading this. On CD, the audio recording, $45. Because it's physical CDs, I guess it'd be a lot of them. On digital download, $45. I mean, what is the point? Like, are you afraid they won't buy the CD if the digital download is cheaper? It should be cheaper. It's not a physical product. It's ridiculous. And then the ebook is available for $15. So which are you going to buy? People say, oh, ebooks have peaked. People love print, blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry. It's half the price.
You know what? I'm going to buy it on vinyl.
Absolutely. And why
are they making hardcover on Amazon right now is $22.58.
There you go. So that's pretty much the lowest anybody will have. And again, I wonder, why not make it available in paperback as well? You've already got the cheap version, which is ebook. Why make people wait a year for the option of buying it on paperback? If you can make the sale today for $12 or $14, why wait a year? It doesn't make any sense to me. Make it available in every format. Some people love Elvis. They're going to want the hardcover. If they want the cheaper version, well, you're already making the ebook available. So what are you so scared of?
Well, here's my question. When you almost ran him over a couple years ago, did he say, don't worry, accidents will happen. They only hit and run. You used to be a victim. Now you're not the only one.
Keep going.
See, that's the lyrics to Accidents Will Happen.
I got it.
Okay. Hey, that was pretty fast. Come on. You got to.
Very good. Well.
Now, would Fox fire Taraji P. Henson? ABC fire Shonda Rhimes?
No. Shonda Rhimes might fire ABC, but
that's
not
true.
The other way around.
Now, would NBC fire Adam Levine from The Voice?
Maybe.
Yeah, well, not easily. They wouldn't. But the BBC is firing Jeremy Clarkson, the host of the hugely successful worldwide smash hit show Top Gear. Clarkson has repeatedly embarrassed the BBC with both on-air comments and off-air misbehavior. Of course, punching a producer doesn't constitute misbehavior. That's technically assault, and apparently it's the last straw. So Clarkson is out of a job, and one of the most popular shows in the world is without its Simon Cowell-like dominating figure. The other two hosts are also likely gone, so the show will have to reinvent itself from top to bottom. Top Gear airs in more than 200 countries and brought in $225 million in revenue just last year. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm confused.
I'm not confused. I'm already... I'm putting my resume over there right now. I think, Michael, you've just proved that you don't know how to drive. So, you know, you're running people over. You're perfect. And I can figure something out to talk about cars.
It's too late because they just announced Trevor Noah will be the new head of Top Gear.
Good grief. That guy's taking all the jobs.
Right. So I'm a little confused. I don't understand the different valuations of how much this show brought in. This one report from the Hollywood Reporter said $225 million a year. Another one said $75 million a year. But I'm looking, and this is for an entire year, and I'm thinking, so they're in 200 countries and they're only bringing in $1 million per country? That's as much as they're making in an entire year on a hit show? Doesn't that seem low to you?
No, because it depends on certain countries. The viewership may be very low, as is the advertising price. So they, you know.
Yes, but in big countries, presumably you're making a lot more money. I mean, you don't make $1 million a year in America on a show. And I know Top Gear is not a big show here in America. It's like the one market where it's not really big. But, you know, when you've got American Idol or variations of Idol in all these countries, you're making a hell of a lot more than $1 million in an entire year. It just seemed low to me. $75 million, that's it? I don't know.
Well, I'm not an expert in that area. But moving on, Apple is going heavy into streaming music, which I already thought they were in. So
yes.
So my question is, what's the delay? Well, they tried to convince major labels to give Apple a discount so they could charge $8 a month rather than the $10 a month Spotify and others charge. That was a no-go, in part because Apple isn't the dominant force in music that it was a few years ago. So they're still shaping the service, insisting it be artist-friendly, seamless, and easy to use. And labels love that there will be no free version. You gotta pay to play. No name yet, but it won't be Beats Music. So the smart money says, given their trend, it'll be called, I would guess, Apple Music? Branding, I guess. A big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, because this is the 8,000th story about Apple tentatively, possibly, soon, maybe, getting into streaming music.
They're also going to be possibly, maybe, at someday, you know, in the future, making a television.
The one thing I like is that we do have an explanation for what took them so long. And Apple, which is known for being a premium service, I love that they wanted to undercut their competitors. We want to charge $8 a month.
They had no choice. They had no choice. I mean, they're so late that the only way to get in is to really undercut everybody, or at least...
Well, I don't think so at all. I think all they got to do is offer a good service. You know, they're really good at creating a seamless experience, unless you think Spotify is perfect. When you have... How many, half a trillion people already, or half a billion people already in the iTunes world, adding on a streaming service, which they just pops up on their phone and pops up on their thing. And there it is. All you can do is press a button. You're already registered because you're already a member. It's very, very easy. And you can sample it for a week. And then you want to buy, you can buy it. It's so easy to do and so easy to introduce that I think, they will be a formidable competitor when they ever get their act together.
Now, Jimmy Buffett turned his mellow Florida Keys persona into a massively successful chain of clothing and bars, and of course, a margarita mix. So why not Willie Nelson? And why not pot? Nelson has been a proponent of legalizing pot and ending the idiocy of prohibition, so he's a natural fit for giving his stamp of approval to a strain of marijuana. Or as Michael likes to call it, Mary Jane. It seems in the early stages, but Nelson plans to open at least one store in 2016 in a state that is ready for straightforward sales of marijuana for private use. There'll be an umbrella for their own homegrown strains like Willie Reserve, as well as offering to distribute locally grown strains that meet their standards for environmentally friendly, sort of the way, you know, Whole Foods will carry regional fruits and vegetables from farmers. Nelson will offer vaporizers and the like. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal.
What? Stories this week, I thought you would be like, really? Why do we have this story on the lineup?
It's not locked in stone yet. They seem a little vague, but dear God.
Yeah. Wait, you mean they're having trouble kind of...
making up their minds and they're in a haze. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they're pulling a Seth Rogen. No, but I just think, wow, actually, if you were trying to market marijuana nationally, what better name to slap on it than Willie Nelson? I mean, that absolutely would, like, people go, hey, they trust him. He's iconic and he knows his pot. And you just feel like, yeah, I'll try that. I mean, that would be you'd reach for the first time out. And Cheech and Chong must be somewhere going, son of a bitch. Why did this have to happen 20 years too late? Yeah, we would have been perfect.
We're way ahead of our time.
Yeah.
Now, the worldwide smash hit TV series Downton Abbey is calling it quits. The show's producers announced this fall's sixth season would be the soap opera's last. It's true the show has ever so slightly peaked in audience, but it will still draw, massive numbers in the UK, around 12 million viewers a week. And of course, it's a hit all over the world. A statement explaining the decision said, and this is a quote, "We wanted to close the doors of Downton Abbey when it felt right and natural for the storylines to come together. And when the show is still being enjoyed so much by its fans. A feature film is just a gleam in the eye of the show's producers, but a possibility down the road. Big deal or big whoop?"
Well, it was a big deal for my mom. We had to put her on suicide watch. She and all her friends were like, what? I'm barely exaggerating. Thank God Call the Midwife is still on. But I want to know something, Sperling. What the hell is going on? Seriously, I do not have the slightest idea. I mean, that statement, give me a break. Like, why in God's name did they cancel the show? I have no idea.
I think a lot of the actors were kind of done with it and they wanted to move on. So
are the actors all insane? Because if they're any normal actor, they know the actors on Grey's Anatomy aren't done. And you bring in new characters and new people. I mean, no, this boggles my mind. I still don't have no explanation for why this show is being canceled.
It's not being canceled. They are.
They've ended it one more year and they're out. This could have run 10 years, 12 years. This is a huge moneymaker. I have no explanation of why this show was canceled. None. Julian Fellowes, however, may be the reason. He has this show for NBC called The Gilded Age. He won't start work on it until he's done with this. He wasn't going to leave this until it's over. And I think maybe he wanted to walk away. Nobody suggested this, but he's going to, you know, wants to finish the show, take a break, and then start on the NBC show. And maybe with, like you say, one or two key actors saying, I don't know if we want to keep doing, you know, I'm not going to renew.
And maybe especially without Julian Fellowes there, they may have said,
plus that and Julian, they said, you know what? But again, this is a show that, you know, you can carry on after Julian Fellowes is gone. It's not rocket science. You can carry on West Wing with Aaron Sorkin. You can sure as hell carry on with Downton Abbey. This is a huge moneymaker. I just find it unbelievably puzzling. And nobody seems to be going, wait, why are you ending the show? Why are you ending a big smash hit?
Well, and you have in the past kind of faulted people like Ryan Murphy, producers and showrunners like Ryan Murphy, for kind of moving on and just leaving their shows flapping out there in the wind like they moved on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, good for Julian Fellowes to stay. And if he thought it met its time, right? But, you know, this is just not a good show. So it's just a big moneymaker. So that's what I don't understand. It's not like a creative work where I'm excited to make sure it ends on top and tells the story well. I would understand why Breaking Bad went the time it did. But Downton Abbey is a soap. And it's a huge moneymaker. And, you know, Julian Fellowes wants to pretend, no, I must protect my baby. Well, good for him. But, you know, I don't understand why the network is letting it end. It boggles my mind. And nobody seems to be questioning it. They're like, oh, of course. It's seen its time. I mean, you know, I just find it weird. In the terms of business, I think this is the most head-scratching, puzzling choice of the year. Well, let's end a smash hit show.
Well, speaking of business, it's time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
All right. So I have a friend who's a casting director, and every year when they're casting some plays in New York, she always says, oh, God, it's so hard to get people right now because everybody's in L.A. for casting season. So this is a seasonal thing that happens. Even though shows are made year-round now, there still is the tradition of certain times of the year when a lot of pilots are getting made. Episodes to show the network and say, hey, do we want to go forward? Do we not? And so the pilot season is still a really big deal, even though there are lots of changes in the film industry. So what's happening in pilot season this year?
Well, I guess following the success of what shows like How to Get Away with Murder, speaking of Shonda Rhimes, Black-ish, Fresh Off the Boat, you got Jane the Virgin and, you know, come on, Empire, talk about a phenomenon. These are all shows with minority cast members, ethnic cast members. You have everybody in Hollywood. What does Hollywood do? They basically chase trends. Okay, so all of those shows are hits. So now everybody wants to make television shows with ethnic and racial minorities.
Forgetting, of course, that shows aren't hits because they have black characters or white characters in them. They're hits because they're good and entertaining.
That's right. And so what's beginning to happen is a lot of these casting agents are kind of saying
casting directors.
Sorry, you're right. Casting directors are saying, "Gee, I can't get any of my Caucasian actors roles."
Oh, please.
That's
you're kidding. You're lying.
I'm not lying. It was in the story on Deadline.
Deadline. Thank you. Deadline. Is there a single person quoted saying poor white people, they can't get work?
Well, they're not saying poor white people. They're just saying
Poor my Caucasian actors. They can't get cast. That's what you just said. Who is quoted? Is there one person quoted by name saying white people can't get work?
It's entertainment journalism. Is anybody ever quoted by name?
Of course they are. I've never done an anonymous quote in my life. Is there one person quoted by name? Of course not, because that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. A, welcome to my world, bitch, is what they would all be saying. Since if you're a black or Caucasian, you know, you're a Latino person of color, you rarely get cast. You know, so for decades you've been fighting, and now suddenly because you're getting a few roles, the vast majority of roles are still Caucasian. The vast majority of shows are still led by white actors. The idea that like white people can't get work, we're like, oh, the networks don't want to cast them in that second role. Give me a break.
Well, there was one anonymous quote saying basically 50% of the roles in a pilot have to be ethnic. That's what
why not 70%? Why not 40%? And it's like whatever is right for the role. I mean, it's great to be proactive and say, hey, you want different faces and voices. And not because, oh, you're giving work to people of color, but because when you do shows like Empire, you're telling new stories that we haven't seen before. When you're doing Fresh Off the Boat, you're telling a story we haven't seen before. It's not that, oh, I want to watch that show with a Korean on it. It's I want to watch a show that's fresh and funny. So to think that anybody would be so stupid as to say, well, half the roles have to be ethnic, that's just moronic as well.
Well, I guess there was also some talk that in the past, shows weren't written with a specific race.
Well, sometimes the character is they always assume white, and sometimes they cast a black person in the role, like Viola Davis, right?
Viola Davis, that is correct. How to Get Away with Murder was not written as an African-American woman. It was just written.
Right, by Shonda Rhimes, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, once they had folks like Viola Davis and Halle Berry interested, they said, well, okay, fine. That's who'll play the part, and that's the way it should be. You get the best actress for the job.
There's nothing wrong with being proactive and saying the cast should reflect the world, because that's just smart. Why do you want shows with lily white casts when that doesn't reflect America? It doesn't reflect your audience. So it's smart to be proactive. It's stupid to have exact specific, oh, no, we've already got 49%. We can only have one more white person. You know, that's kind of stupid, you know, if there's a, you know, but, you know, the idea that white people are suffering and can't get work. Give me a break. That is just the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Deadline should be ashamed of itself. If someone's not willing to go on the record to say malarkey like that, ignore them.
Well, what are some of the shows that are coming up? Do we have any shows? We have, Rosewood, which Morris Chestnut is going to star in, right? And that's over at Fox.
Right.
You have Uncle Buck is being rebooted, actually. I didn't know Uncle Buck was booted the first time.
Other than as a movie. Black family. That's hilarious.
Okay. And then you have Love is a Four-Letter Word. NBC is making that.
Right. And Anika Noni Rose, who is a terrific stage actress. I'm sorry she's doing a show, frankly, because she's just a great talent. But, you know, it'll raise her visibility and help her perhaps be an even bigger draw on Broadway eventually. But she's starring in a CBS civil rights drama called For Justice. Why couldn't that star a white person? A civil rights drama. So, yeah, there's a lot of shows and, you know, hey, great.
And I love all the comments of this Deadline piece. They talked about reverse racism. Frankly, you can't say reverse racism, because if it's racist, it's racist, and it's racism. Reverse racism
means unracist.
Right, correct.
But we know what the phrase means.
Yes. And there's some talk in this piece about, well, you know, with so many shows featuring minorities.
So many, like five.
Well,
so many shows.
Well, there's more choice. And now
I think if you watch the lineup of CBS, you're not going to see, you know, the UN up there. You'll see a shows like usual with perhaps a little more color in them.
Well, they're just saying that, you know, the audience might become a little bit more fractured and, you know.
Fractured? That's the whole point. See, that's the stupid thing. They always said if you make a show starring a black person, only black people will want to watch. Of course, black people want to turn in because there were so few darn shows that they could see themselves reflected on. It's natural. Gay people watched really bad gay films for a long time because there were no movies with gay characters unless they were suicidal or hilariously gay. So the point is not that these shows are only going to attract people who are Korean or black or Latina. It's that they're going to attract audiences because they're good shows, and you're cutting yourself off on the arm when you ignore a lot of talented actors just because they're people of color, and you're cutting yourself off from a lot of stories you can't tell with white people, and certainly not tell effectively or tell from the inside. So no, you make good shows. Empire is not a hit because it stars black people. It's a hit because it's fun. And Taraji P. Henson, Oscar nominee, is really great in a breakout role, just like Joan Collins was great on Dynasty. That's it.
Well, certainly it for Gene Sachs.
Oh, golly, yes. 93 years old, legendary, yeah, three-time Tony winner, so a legendary Broadway director, a long, distinguished career. He started off as an actor. He acted for like 15 years before he got his first break as a director. He was in the original cast of South Pacific. He was in a revival of South Pacific, and then he said, you know what, I can't do South Pacific anymore. I got to become a director. So he became a director and a long association with Neil Simon.
What was interesting to me is that he was married to Bea Arthur.
Yeah, they were married for quite a while, but they did divorce, and she died a few years ago. Now, he died now just after, a few weeks after, really, the complete box set of Maud came out, one of Bea Arthur's iconic shows. So, yeah, they were married. I don't know what their relationship was like afterwards, but he directed her in the original stage production of MAME, and then he directed the film production, the god-awful version starring Lucille Ball, when it should have been Angela Lansbury. So that was a real missed opportunity. But he directed other movies, often Neil Simon. It was all stuff based on theater work, and often Neil Simon. He did the film version of The Odd Couple, which is a big hit. He did the film version of Barefoot in the Park, and you know, he's really will always be associated with Neil Simon. He directed the whole trilogy that is really remade Neil Simon from a funny comedy writer to a serious playwright. People actually started to really look at his work and say, hey, this guy has talent. And that was Brighton Beach Memoirs, Biloxi Blues, which is a delightful movie, and Broadway Bound.
I will never forget the line in Biloxi Blues, it's hot. It's Africa hot.
Yeah, exactly. I knew you were going to say that one. Yeah, no, it's a sweet movie. Matthew Broderick is in it. And, you know, it's much better than Working Girl. I don't know why I associated the two, but they came out the same year. And I just thought Biloxi Blues was delightful.
Well, I'm sure Broadway will miss him. And hopefully our listeners will miss us next week because we are taking a week off, just as a reminder.
You are taking a week
off.
Okay,
that's true.
I will be talking into the wall, arguing and yelling about the events of the week.
Okay, well, but, you know, maybe you can argue and yell at some of our listeners who will write to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free is usually where we can be found. And please do rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. I should actually maybe one day go see if MySpace is still around.
I don't know.
I know, Michael, you're still around. And every week you have a brand new and exciting website for us to go visit to see some of your work. What is it this week?
This week's it is canijoinonedirection.com.
Well, you know, if Michael isn't on One Direction, or if you're looking for some of his coverage of the entertainment industry, you can probably go to michaelgiltz.com or Huffington Post. Or
MySpace, which is still there.
Okay. Or maybe go over to bookfilter.com.
Please do.
Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.